Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going
to
find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. They're real clients. They're banking clients. Are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hey, everybody. This is Peter Schiff. Welcome again to another live episode of Wall Street Unspun. I'm Peter Schiff. I'm president of Euro Pacific Capital and host of the show, author of the new book, Crash Proof, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse. This is a live show. I do it every Wednesday evenings at 8 p.m., 5 p.m. Pacific time. The call-in show, the number to call is 888-678-9597. That's 888-678-9597. And again, the show can be heard live on shortwave radio, 5.07 megahertz, and also on my website at www.europac.net. And anyway, the telephone lines are open. So again, it's 888-678-9597. I think quite a lot to talk about on this show. First of all, I want to just a couple of announcements. The Freedom Fest is next week. I will be in Las Vegas next week. In fact, I probably will do the show. I mean, maybe somebody will do it for me, but I should be able to do it. But if I do it, I will be doing it live from my hotel room in Las Vegas. Freedom Fest. There's some activity that's going on the Wednesday. I got to check the calendar if it conflicts with the show or not, if there's a cocktail reception, if it's at 5, if it's at 6. But if I can do the show, I will. Otherwise, maybe Eric will do it, Eric Steingrubner, or I don't know about John. He might be on vacation. We'll work something out. But or maybe I'll do part of the show. But hopefully I'll see some of the listeners there at the Freedom Fest. We do have a booth. Eric Steingrubner will be there with me in the booth, who's manager of the Newport Beach office. And I'll be speaking twice. I think I have one 40-minute presentation and one 20-minute presentation, and there's some other people there. I'm sure, hopefully, the bookstore this time will have copies of my book, which, you know, if you buy them there, I'll be able to sign them. Last time at the Money Show in Las Vegas, the bookstores were there. My book was out, and the bookstore just didn't bother to bring any copies of my book. Also, if anybody happened to catch it, I was on CNBC today at closing bell at 4 o'clock. I was also on Fox News a couple of days ago. Now, the tentative, what I have scheduled right now, I should be on Kudlow and Company on CNBC 5 o'clock on Monday. Also, I booked another Kudlow and Company for a week from Wednesday. So not this coming Wednesday, which is 4th of July, but the following Wednesday, I will also be on Kudlow & Company. So that's two appearances, one Monday and one a week from Wednesday, sometime between 5 and 6. There's also a good chance, it depends if I want to do it or not, they invited me to be on Bulls and Bears this Saturday, but I have to tape it at an inconvenient time at 6 p.m. Friday evening. I'm going to be in the Hamptons for the weekend, and so I'm not sure if I'm going to do it or not. I'd like to do it, but it could be too big of a hassle. But you can always check and see if I decide to do it. You know, that will be shown. It's a tape show. They tape it Fridays, but it will be shown on Saturday morning. It's on at 10 a.m. I think, or actually 10:30. Bulls and Bears. No, Bulls and Bears is the top of the hour, so I think it's on at 10 a.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific time. The news has obviously been coming out recently has to do with, you know, the additional losses showing up related to mortgages and related to particularly subprime mortgages. But, you know, this is something, going back to what I've been writing for years, what I wrote in my book, what I've been saying on this program on television, talking about the housing bubble and how big this is, how pervasive this is, how much of a problem it is. And the mainstream media, Wall Street, keeps trying to brush it under the rug, keep trying to say this is it, we're at the bottom, it's contained, there's no spillover. This is all a bunch of nonsense, but more and more evidence starts to come out. Now, initially what happened is, you know, a few months back, there was a, you know, the first real evidence. I mean, obviously it was obvious to me. I didn't need any evidence. This was crystal clear years ago. But the first real evidence to everybody else in Wall Street that there was a problem was all of a sudden we started to see a lot of delinquencies in subprime. And these delinquencies caused a lot of buyers of subprime loans who had just bought them to basically return these bonds to the originators. And all of a sudden, the originators were having problems. They were having to buy back loans that they sold, and they were finding that Wall Street really no longer wanted to buy additional bonds. So a lot of these subprime lenders went out of business. And that resulted in a tightening of lending standards, still not traditionally tight, but not as crazily loose as they once were. But this was the beginning where people said, okay, there's a problem with subprime. And Wall Street ignored it, and they acted like there was no problem. But meanwhile, there are hundreds of billions of these securities out there that are just as bad quality as these as those recent ones. And now we're finally starting to see some of the losses that are going to be felt by the holders of these bonds. And, you know, I've written in commentaries and talked about for a long time the real losers, the real big losers in the housing bubble are not going to be people that overpaid for houses or bought houses in the bubble, particularly people who bought with, you know, nothing down. Or many people bought, put a down payment, but they bought 2 or 3 years ago, and as their home increased in value, they did cash out withdrawals so that they've already taken out more than their original down payment. And that money has been spent on new cars, on vacations, on, you know, appliances, on whatever they bought. So these people have nothing to lose. They don't have any real money invested in these houses. Either, you know, they have no investment at all, or they've already been paid and taken profits out. The real losses are going to be suffered from the lenders, right? The people that loaned other people money to buy houses or against the so-called value, the home equity that they had. Because when these loans end up in default, it's the lenders who are the losers. And, you know, I remember when I would read articles in the paper talking about these no down payment loans, zero down, and they would always talk about how risky they were from the point of view of the borrower. They would say, oh, they're very risky because if you borrow money without a down payment and then the market goes down, you have negative equity, therefore that's risky. Well, I mean, they had it backwards. Therefore, it wasn't risky. I mean, if the market went down and you had no down payment, you had nothing to lose, right? Zero down means zero risk for the buyer, right? The reason that there are down payments is not to protect the buyer. The down payment is there to protect the lender, right? It's because and what the down payment does is, you know, it makes sure that not only does the lender have some skin in the game and he has something to lose, but one of the reasons that people were, you know, these liar's loans, these stated income mortgages were so popular and so many people lied about their incomes and their assets was because there were no negative ramifications to them if they couldn't afford these mortgages. I mean, the reason that people were willing to commit to mortgages they couldn't afford was because if they couldn't make the payments, so what? I mean, well, there was no negative consequences, really. I mean, maybe a blemish on their credit market, but you know, that compared to the huge upside if the real estate market kept rising, as everybody anticipated. You know, there was a huge, you know, pot of gold at the end of the rainbow if you just signed on the dotted line. But to the extent that a home buyer had to fork over $25,000, $50,000, $100,000 of their hard-earned savings, You know, there's no way that somebody would do that and then commit to a teaser rate that jumped up to, in 2 or 3 years, to a level that they knew they couldn't afford, because that act would put their down payment in jeopardy. People would think, wait a minute, if I can't make these mortgage payments, they're going to foreclose, they're going to sell my house, I could lose this down payment. So, that, you know, that kept people honest. And again, the down payment protected the lender. It was never meant to protect the borrower. I mean, sure, why would a borrower want to put anything down? It makes no sense. It's the lenders that want something down. But anyway, so we're just starting to see the tip of the iceberg with the losses, because now Bear Stearns, a couple of these hedge funds that actually owned, you know, several billion dollars of this, you know, subprime debt, which, you know, we set up this partnership some time ago to short for our clients and people who got involved in it. I mean, it's huge. But we shorted this subprime debt. But Bear Stearns, these hedge funds, they owned it. And up until recently, they were marking these things to a theoretical market based on the credit rating. I mean, these bonds were rated triple B or A or whatever they were. And so they were pricing them off their credit rating, which was bogus, and not off of the real value. Well, over the last couple of weeks, a couple of these funds were forced to write down that value to something more realistic. And actually what happened is they started losing some money, and some of the investors in these hedge funds, you know, called up the hedge fund and said, you know what, I want my money back. Well, then the hedge funds, in order to give them their money back, they would have to sell some of these bonds. Well, the problem is no one wants to buy them. And basically we find out, I mean, or people are starting to find out that the values that are on their books are fiction. And many of these bonds that hedge funds and, you know, pension funds and everybody are saying are worth par or, you know, 95 or something like that are really only worth 20 or 30. You know, they're dramatically overstating the value of these assets. And, of course, a lot of these assets have been pledged and have been used as collateral for loans. And, of course, once you write down the value of the asset, now the loan is not collateralized and immediate money has to come up. That's the big problem with these hedge funds. And this is just the beginning. It's not just a couple of hedge funds, and Bear Stearns is trying to bail them out with a cash infusion. But this is not the last hedge fund that's going to be bailed out. I mean, these securities are owned by a wide number of hedge funds, and it's not going to be long before investors in a number of these funds realize that these valuations are phony, and they try to get their money back. And, you know, the minute that people want their money back, it's not there. Now, all of a sudden, the hedge fund managers have to sell out these bonds, and, of course, nobody wants to buy them. But the minute they trade in the market, you get a real price. And now it makes it difficult for people to pretend that these bonds are worth par when they just traded at 30 cents on the dollar. This is what Wall Street is so afraid of, an official recognition that these securities are, in fact, worthless. And basically, and many of these securities are worthless. The bondholders have no prayer of collecting one quarter on these things. And, you know, this is a huge unfolding story. You know, as I said, this is the tip of a huge, huge iceberg. And again, the average, you know, Wall Street analyst or economist or politician is just brushing this under the rug again, assuming that this means nothing. And this is huge. And taken against the backdrop that we have now with rising interest rates and all that's going on, you know, this is going to further impact credit, because basically the subprime market is really dead. And what is also going to happen is the lenders who are realizing the mistakes that they made, they're going to start to want down payments. They're going to want to make sure that people have something to risk and make sure that there's some collateral in the event that they do foreclose, that there's not 100% loan to value. They've got to have. And so what's going to happen is the minute the lenders require down payments, nobody's got any down payments. I mean, who's going to get a down payment, especially a first-time home buyer? I mean, we have a negative savings rate. And, of course, you know, they're not going to let people have teaser rates or interest-only rates. So the only way we can have some kind of equilibrium in the housing market is for real estate prices to collapse and for people to stop spending and start saving up those down payments, which means a big recession, which puts even more pressure on real estate prices. And if you look at the news we got from the home builders, we just got news, and this is, you know, shows you the ridiculous how these government numbers are. On Tuesday, the government reported that new home prices rose over the last year. Meanwhile, Lennar came out with disastrous losses. Wall Street was looking for a small prop. They had a huge loss. And basically, the CEO of Lennar said, we're losing money because the house prices are falling. and we're selling these houses for much lower prices. Well, the government claims that prices are up. Well, how can prices be up if Lennar is losing a fortune because prices are down? It's just another example of how ridiculous a government number is, you know, and they just should be taken with a grain of salt because it's all a bunch of nonsense because they conflict with reality. Meanwhile, most of the home builders hit 52-week lows this week. They bounced a little bit today, but these stocks look like crap. These charts look terrible. Most of these stocks, I think, are going to make a round trip. You know, most of them in 2000 were all about $5 a share, and by 2004, they were all up at 60, 70, 80 bucks. Now they're all down in the 20s and 30s, and I think they're all headed back down to $5. Some of them might go lower. And this is a huge warning sign for the future of the housing market where these home builders are just imploding. And you know what? The business going forward for home builders is abysmal because they've overbuilt. There are so many homes that nobody owns. There are so many homes that people bought that they don't need, that they can't afford, that are going to come back on the market. There's going to be a huge glut. No one's going to be building any homes because the cost of building them is going to be more expensive than what the ones that are already there are going to be selling for. Anyway, we got a couple of people on the phone right now, so let me go to the phones. Before I do, I will just give out the number one more time for additional callers. It's 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. Let me go to Steven from Hamburg, Germany. Go ahead, Steve.
Hey, Peter, can you hear me?
I can hear you very well. Guten Tag.
Danke. Wie geht es dir? Hey, I had a couple quick questions. One of them, about the articles that were on your site about the infrastructure in America getting too old and that in relation to inflation out there. There's no inflation. I was just checking prices on tickets to come back to the States, and they're 200% more than what they were 3 years ago. No inflation there. I'm still trying to learn the basics of how the bond market works and how that relates to the value of currencies. Could you just give me a quick rendition of how the bond
market... The bond market, every country has its own bond market, but basically what bonds represent is future payments of a particular currency. So U.S. dollar-denominated bonds, whether they're treasuries or corporates, represent an obligation to pay the bearer dollars at some point in time in the future. And either it's the U.S. government that's promising to make the payment, or it's a corporation or a municipality. And there's going to be a rate of interest, of course, which is going to vary depending on how creditworthy the borrower is. But ultimately, what determines prices in the bond market is supply and demand. And if you have a lot of people looking to borrow money relative to, few people looking to, who are saving, looking to lend money, which would be the case in the United States, we would have a high rate of interest. Also, to the extent that there's a lot of inflation, the more inflation there is, the more premium lenders are going to demand to loan money, because if they're getting paid back in the future and there's inflation, then they're being paid back in dollars or of diminished value. So the higher inflation is, generally, the bigger the premium somebody is going to demand to loan you money, if you're going to pay them back in the future. And, of course, the further into the future, the bigger that premium needs to be. The problem in the United States, or what has been, the benefit to us is that even though we have a very minimal supply of domestic savings, there's an ample supply of global savings. And the world has made their savings available to us, which is one of the reasons that interest rates have remained low. Also, for whatever reason, the world is convinced that there's not a lot of inflation, and inflation is not likely to accelerate, and so the premiums haven't been high. Now, I think the world is dead wrong. I think they believe the government hype, although I think to a much larger extent it's because foreign governments have been doing a lot of buying, and so they're not buying for a rational, economic interest. They're buying for a political interest, and I think that's more the reason that our bond yields have stayed where they are, is because of this giant subsidy from foreign governments who are not thinking. I think a lot of private people around the world already realize that our inflation numbers are bullshit, and they don't want to buy our bonds. That's why their governments are doing it for them, and they're doing it, again, for political reasons that I believe, and I talk about this a lot or write about it in my book, that these are very short-sighted opinions of the U.S.'s role in the global economy, and I think a lot of countries are operating under delusion if they feel that American consumer demand is somehow vital to the success of their economies. And if they think that their policy needs to be to keep Americans spending, whatever the cost, I mean, hopefully, for their sakes, they will discover how much nonsense this is. And then they'll stop buying our bonds and stop buying our dollar, and then, you know, we're going to have interest rates up in the stratosphere over here.
Well, I'm watching all the different indicators that you're pointing out and that I'm seeing in the news about all the central banks around the world raising interest rates and, you know, certain countries backing out of the dollar peg. So all the signs are happening there. So they're slowly starting to wake up.
Yeah, I know. It has been a slow wake up. You know, and the thing is, like, you know, I do these shows. I do this show on CNBC today, and again, my bullish opponent in a bull bear debate, basically his, you know, counter to what I was saying was, you know, yes, you're correct in many respects. You know, we're selling off our assets, and eventually, you know, we're consuming. But people have been saying that for years. We've been doing this for years. Therefore, you know, we can keep doing it. And that's all that anybody can say is, yes, I understand what you're saying, but so far it hasn't been a problem. Well, I disagree that it has. It's been a problem. I mean, our balance sheets have deteriorated dramatically, but, you know, it hasn't been a fatal problem. It's just like the same way, you know, someone could be smoking cigarettes for 20 years and they don't have cancer, and then all of a sudden they get it. And it's because of the buildup over the years. I mean, the smoking was creating problems. It just wasn't evident because it hadn't gotten to the point of, a cancer. But you know, we could be very close. I mean, you know, we could be very close to the point where all this consuming and borrowing and gutting of our infrastructure, we could be on the point of an economic cancer that, you know, it's taken 20 years to build up, but, you know, then we die. And, you know, people make the mistake of assuming that, well, you know, so far nothing bad has happened, so nothing bad ever will, or maybe it will happen, but it's going to happen in the long term. You know, I think we're in the long term. I think we're the long term from 20 years ago. We were finally there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, nobody really studies the history of money, that the repeat, you know, this repetitive cycle of any nation or country that has, you know, done what America's doing, the currency goes away eventually. It's just history over.
Been able to get my book out there in Germany?
Yeah, no, I've read it, and I've been requesting it to, or suggesting to other people. I just got a couple of my friends to buy it and read it.
Is it in any bookstores out there?
No, I haven't noticed in the bookstores here. We've been buying it on Amazon.com or Amazon.uk. So it's over in the UK. But that, you know, that one point right there, of course there's been major changes. I mean, I was just talking to my mother tonight. I keep trying to get her out of her assets that are, you know, only 30% overseas. And, you know, I'm saying, Mom, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, you know, was one person able to, you know, generate an income enough for a good lifestyle? And she's like, yeah. I'm like, well, can one person even survive on an income now? And she's like, no. I'm like, yeah, there's a major change. It's just so gradual that nobody sees it. You know, and they,
and then not only that, they try to think it's progress. They sort of say, oh, it's women's liberation. You know, that we, you know, women have more options. They don't have more options. They have fewer options. Before, they had the option to work. Now they have to work.
Yeah, exactly.
They no longer have the option to stay home.
Nope, not at all. And then, you know, the whole family suffers. The kids suffer. Everybody suffers. So it's terrible. That's what I'm trying to educate people on out here, you know, in preparation for the euro going through the same thing in the future. Because my son's going to grow up out here, and I want him to be prepared for that. Just one last quick question regarding to or relating to bonds. How do I keep track or be able to see what the interest rates are? Where do I look up, you know, what?
Well, you know, I mean, I just look at the futures contracts. There's symbols like TYX and TNX that can give you the 10-year, the 30-year yield on U.S. Treasuries. I mean, in all kinds of newspapers and Barron's and Wall Street Journal, you can get rates. You can get, you know, Fed funds, overnight rates, prime rates. You can, you know, get track. You can keep track of major interest rate indices to see what's going on with interest rates.
Okay, because that's the next thing I want to
study. Yeah. Hey, thanks for the call. What time is it out there? Actually, it's probably, is it late at night, early in the morning? Or?
Yeah, it's late at night. It's 2:30 in the morning. Well, late at night for me, but it's early in the morning. It's 2:30 in the morning, but I try and get on your call and connect every once in a while.
All right. Hey, well, thanks for the call. I'm glad that people are listening. Are you on the shortwave or Internet?
I'm listening on the Internet and calling you through Skype.
Okay, great.
Yeah, works out great. Hey, thanks again, Peter. Good talking to you.
Sure. Thanks for the call.
All right.
Let me give you, we're going to take a quick break. I will be back. I know we've got one person on hold. I'm giving out the number again in case you want to queue up. 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be back for any more calls on the rest of the show.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that has passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
Okay, we're back. And again, it's Peter Schiff. You are listening to Wall Street Unspun at 5.07 megahertz, shortwave, and www.europac.net on the internet. And the number to call, toll-free, 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. And patiently waiting on the phone is Richard from Orange County, California. Go ahead, Richard.
Peter, I just watched, not just watched, but I watched the video, America, Freedom to Fascism. So I was curious as to how your dad's doing, and I think he should be considered a hero. And my second question is, do you support Ron Paul for president? And I'll let you answer. Thanks.
Well, my dad is, his health seems to be okay. I mean, he is, in a federal prison in New Jersey. And, I regard him as a political prisoner, but he's there. And I visited him on Father's Day, and he's in good spirits. Unfortunately, he may likely remain in prison for the rest of his life. You know, he got a 13-year sentence for what the government considered tax evasion, although he certainly... the government presented no evidence at all that my father actually evaded any taxes. In fact, my father is probably one of the few people in this country who doesn't evade their taxes. He's one of the probably files one of the few 100% honest returns among of anybody that I know. If anybody did not commit tax evasion, it's certainly my father. But, I mean, that's not why he's in jail. The government doesn't like what he has to say, and they didn't want him to say it. They wanted to discredit him. But he's 78 years old, and he got 13 years in jail. So his life expectancy is not quite as long as his sentence. So, unfortunately, he might have to remain in jail for the rest of his life. I'm hopeful that there's a chance that he could get a honest judge in an appeal. And if for any reason, maybe his advanced age and the obvious biases in the trial and all the other errors, the reversible errors, I mean, if an axe murderer had the type of trial my father had and he killed, 20 people, they would let him out because of all the errors in the trial. But, as far as the government's concerned, my father is far more of a danger than an axe murderer because he represents a danger to the government's illegal collection of taxes. And so there they're very concerned. But if somebody is just a danger to other citizens, well, they bend over backwards to preserve their constitutional rights for due process. But, if you're out there speaking against, what you believe to be something illegal that the government is doing, well, your constitutional rights go out the window. In answer to your second question, I 100% support Ron Paul. I've talked about that on this program in the past. I mean, at some point I'm still trying to check on some of the legal implications regarding, contributions and recommendations of a political candidate for a broker-dealer. He's the only candidate of either the Democrats or the Republicans who's worth voting for. I mean, if he weren't in the race, it's not even worth the effort to vote. And it's not that he's going to win, but at least there's somebody to vote for. I mean, he's not even a politician. He's a statesman. He's a real guy. I mean, this guy doesn't even, he's rejected his government pension. I mean, he's rejected every pay raise. you know, he's got principles. You know, he doesn't do things to get elected. He doesn't vote for programs because they're popular, because they're going to bring, you know, he votes against special interests in his own, for his own constituents. You know, he's exactly what the framers of the Constitution had in mind for a representative. I mean, he's not even a career politician. He's a doctor. He's been in and out of politics, but he understands the Constitution. And he's the only decent congressman in Congress, and he would be a great president. He'd be the only decent president we've probably had in my lifetime, including Ronald Reagan. I mean, but, you know, I don't kid myself into thinking that he's got a chance of winning. But I think that if we support him and we vote for him and he can do well, that maybe in another 8 years, when this country is really a basket case, and maybe the Democrats and the Republicans will both be so discredited that somebody like Ron Paul, whether he's running as a Republican or as a Libertarian or some other party yet to be formed, maybe he'll have a chance. But, you know, no, he's great. I mean, you should look, you know, go to his website, you know, when you, you know, look for him in the debates. He's a good guy. Ron Paul will be at the Freedom Fest, and I haven't spoken to Ron in a while, but he will be at the Freedom Fest in Las Vegas, and I look forward to talking to him again and wishing him well in his endeavors. Anyway, that call, too, came from Orange County, California, where, you know, we have an office down there. But another casualty, and it didn't get much media attention, but a company called Brooks Street Securities, which is based in Irvine, California, went bankrupt on Friday. And they had about 200 offices nationwide, about 750 brokers, independent brokers, who were laid off. And the firm, you know, had net capital of about $17 million at the end of last month. That means that on their books, they had $17 million of assets that exceeded their liabilities in allowable net cap, which is pretty decent. I mean, that's a lot of net cap, you know. It's a lot more than I've got at Euro Pacific. And in any event, the net cap as of last Friday was negative $5 million. And so in order for the company to meet NASD requirements for net capitalization, the owner would have to write a big check and infuse a bunch of capital into the company, which he did not want to do. And I don't blame him, given all the lawsuits that are now likely to hit his company. In fact, if you do a Google search for Web Street, the first two listings you see are for lawyers, and it basically says, you know, click here to sue, you know. So they had to shut their doors. But you might be wondering, well, what happened? How does a firm go from $17 million in the black to $5 million in the red in less than a month? Well, subprime mortgages. What happened was customers of this company, Brook Street, owned the same type of risky subprime mortgages that these Bear Stearns hedge funds owned. And the crazy thing was they owned them on margin, where they had pledged them as collateral and borrowed money against them. Now, until a few weeks ago, the clearing firm, which is Fidelity, you know, we use Pershing at Euro Pacific. They use Fidelity, but similar to our Pershing, had given those assets a certain valuation and therefore considered them good collateral against all of the debt that was owed in the accounts. Well, all of a sudden, bonds that Fidelity said were worth par or 90 or whatever they were, all of a sudden they're worth 20 or 30. Now these accounts have huge margin calls. Well, as you might guess, a lot of the investors are shell-shocked to learn that they owe, you know, so much money. A lot of them probably didn't have the money or were reluctant to send it in. And so the brokerage firm is ultimately responsible for customer debits. And so these customers lost a lot of money. And now it was up to the clearing firm, it was up to the brokerage firm to make good the clearing firm. You see, that's the risk. I mean, as an owner of Euro Pacific Capital, I mean, if one of my clients doesn't pay for a trade and the stock goes down and there's a loss, I owe the money. I mean, sure, the client owes me and I can always sue the client, but in the meantime, I got to pay Pershing. you know, or, you know, any losses or anything that happens, or if a client's on margin and all of a sudden the stock collapses and now the stock has a debit, it's actually got an unsecured debit where the customer owes $100,000 or $200,000, if the customer decides not to send in the money, I've got to cover it out of my own pocket or out of my company's pocket. And so those are the risks. So here this guy, and I felt bad for the guy because I read the story in the paper. The guy's 59 years old. His whole life, his whole business he built. And I don't think, you know, he didn't run a bucket shop. I mean, it wasn't, you know, this wasn't a bad firm. I mean, these weren't rogue brokers. But obviously they didn't understand the crap that they were buying. They didn't understand the housing bubble and the fraud and the subprime market. They really, you know, I don't think it was deliberate, you know. But a lot of people obviously lost a lot of money, and now, of course, they're going to sue. But again, this just shows it's a much bigger fallout. I mean, there's a lot more individual investors that own this stuff. There are a lot more Brook Street securities out there that are going to go under. There are a lot more hedge funds. This is just the beginning. You know, and also you can appreciate, you know, the fact that, you know, the clients of Europe Pacific Capital, that none of our clients own this crap. We wouldn't let anybody. I mean, if one of my clients, and I've had clients over the last few years wanting to buy, you know, certain stocks that they read about that were in the mortgage business, that owned mortgages, that were paying good dividends. And I had the good sense to tell people, no, don't buy this crap. These dividends are phony. They're taking tremendous amounts of risk, and they're going to blow up one day. But, you know, most people, most brokers out there were clueless. They didn't understand that this stuff was toxic waste. They believed the credit ratings. They said, well, it's rated, you know, double A. Or say, I mean, you know, these ratings mean nothing. You've got to do a little of your own homework and take a look at what they are. You know, because when I first heard of these triple B-rated equity tranches, the ones that, you know, we help some people short, when I first heard about them and I heard they were rated triple B, my first reaction was, you've got to be kidding. These things are rated F. I mean, they're going to go to zero for sure. It wasn't even, in my mind, it wasn't even a question of would there be any losses. In my mind, I knew it was 100% total loss. The minute I heard about it, I said, you've got to be kidding me. Why would anybody in their right mind buy this? Anyway, I got another caller on the line. John is calling from Utah. Go ahead, John.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
Okay, how are you?
Great. Hey, a couple of questions for you. Number one, is your book available in either audio or electronic form?
Not yet. Not yet. The only thing you got audio is all my, you know, my interviews, my radio shows that are in the archives.
Yeah.
But the book itself, I mean, I don't know what happens, what the progression is in the publishing world of, you know, when they go to, you know, books on tape. But I'm sure it'll happen at some point.
Well, I've
no, I mean, too much. I mean, if you just listen to my radio archives, I mean, you're going to get a lot. You're going to get a lot of the stuff that's in the book. I mean, I talk about all this stuff all the time.
Okay. Second question. This is something you seem to get asked fairly frequently, but I'm just curious. I'm thinking that there's going to be a pretty dramatic pullback, both in the United States and global markets, over the summer. And I'm looking to invest at the end of that as opposed to now because I think things might be a little bit pricey now. Can you give me some feedback on that?
It might be. I mean, I don't know. I mean, my feeling is we don't know. I mean, the foreign markets could just as easily rise through the summer's fall. Then what do? I mean, if you're going to take that approach, you know, you should at least get out of U.S. dollars and hold foreign currencies. We can help you, you know, get into a no-load a foreign currency fund or something. You don't want to wait it out in dollars because then you really take a lot of risk. But my personal approach is that given the rate at which central banks around the world are creating money, I just don't feel a real need to hold a lot of cash in any currency. I would much rather own things. Now, I don't want to own expensive things. I don't want to own growth stocks or a lot of hyped up things. But I'd, you know, but if it's a utility, a refinery, a pipeline, an office building, I'd rather own that stuff and get good dividends than just have some government piece of paper. If you look at the rate at which money supply is growing, if the world central banks suddenly act extremely responsibly, really tighten up on monetary growth, you know, really get a handle on inflation, then you'd probably be right. We'd be better off just owning, you know, short-term foreign deposits, you know. But I just don't see that happening. I just, you know, and even if it does, all right, so we're going to take maybe a 10, 20% drop in some of these foreign stocks. I'm willing to ride that out, you know, because the risk of being all in currency, and if they keep inflating, is that the currencies, I mean, really lose a lot more value than that. So I would rather own good, safe, quality things, and that's been my approach. And for the last 7, 8 years, it's really paid off. And I can tell you, during that time, there have been several times where I thought the foreign markets would go down, and, you know, they didn't. They went up even more. So I think that this approach has worked well. And, sure, you could be right. I mean, this summer there could be a big drop. But then again, they could go up big. And then what do you do? So I'd rather get positioned in assets that I prefer to cash and realize that there's always a chance that they're going to go down. But I'm not buying these things to sell them. I'm buying them to keep them. I'm buying them for the dividends. I'm buying them because I'd rather own an income-producing quality business, a good asset, than just own some piece of paper that some government prints, even if it's, you know, a government that's not as irresponsible as ours, because, you know, they always have that potential. I mean, look at what the Japanese are doing with the yen. How much they're printing. I mean, it's like, you know, it's the national pastime now in Japan is selling the yen. I mean, grandmas and everybody, you know, everybody is buying foreign currencies. I mean, it's like, you know, that's what they do now. Because the government is just, you know, printing yen like it's going out of style. And they got the interest rates down so low. I mean, why would anybody, you know, they've got all the savings, yet if they keep it in their own currency, they get nothing.
That's right.
So, I don't know. I mean, you could be right, but I don't know. I mean, I just prefer to get invested and I think that's the better approach than just waiting for a pullback. And there's always a middle ground. You know, you commit some money now and you hold some money back. But, you know, I don't want to hold dollars under any circumstances because I think the biggest risk out there is to the U.S. dollar. So that's the last thing you want.
Great. Thanks, Peter.
Have you read my book? Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. He hadn't. Anyway, let me pause again for the last commercial break. I've got one person on hold. And I'll give out the number again, 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. Any additional calls? Let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that has passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
Okay, we are back. And the number 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. And I've got Steve on the line from Los Angeles. Go ahead, Steve.
Good evening, Peter. Do you have some little characters running around in the background? I think I hear other voices behind.
Yeah, well, my little boy pops his head in here.
That must be it. All right. Is there somewhere I can read something about your dad? I was sort of shocked to hear that story. I had not heard that before.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff on the internet. I mean, his name is Irwin Schiff. And so, you know, just Google him and, you know.
Okay. I've heard other callers.
He sells, I mean, I have some of his books on my site. I recommend it in my book. My father, basically, there was two stages of his life. The early stage was more economics. I mean, he was an insurance man, and then he was in the investment business like me, and he actually testified in Congress against the removal of gold backing from our currency. He gave one of the best testimonies on that, and he was very accurate in his predictions about what would happen to gold and the dollar as a result of breaking the link. So, you know, and he wrote a book called The Biggest Con, How the Government is Fleecing You, and a couple other books that had to do generally with economics. And so those books are up on my site. Then, you know, in that, my dad went off on a tangent, and he started to learn a lot about the government's collection of the income tax and the Social Security tax, and he started reading a lot of law and case law and became very knowledgeable about the Constitution and came to the conclusion that the government was collecting the taxes not only in violation of law but in violation of the Constitution and kind of went on a crusade to try to expose this and to try to, you know, bring this to the attention of the government, to people, and let people know, and you know, that the government was doing this. And, you know, as a result, he's been in and out of jail, but most recently he was finally convicted again, I think for the third time, and pretty much got a life sentence. Despite the fact that, you know, I mean, his second conviction, I mean, the government never has any evidence against him. I mean, in fact, they just railroad him into jail. And I've been to a couple of trials. I mean, it's really, you know, it's something shocking that you know, if people think that we're living in a free country, if they think there's much difference between America and you know, some of these dictatorships around the world, I mean, all I have to do is look at a tax trial for somebody like my dad to realize that that's not the case.
Well, so, I mean, federal trials can be scary things where all the real evidence is excluded. And the judges go along with it.
Well, not only that, but they have exculpable evidence. I mean, the judges know my dad is innocent. The prosecutors know he's innocent. But the last thing that they're looking for is justice. They're looking to make an example. They're looking to discourage his type of speech or his type of behavior. And so he goes to jail.
Well, and that kind of jail term for someone of that age is almost, you know, rare.
My dad's 79 years old. I mean, it's not a violent crime.
Correct.
And it's not even, you know, and it's like not like my dad was hiding. You know, my dad didn't, you know, fill out a tax return and falsely claim, you know, and knowingly evade taxes. My father basically tells the government, look, you know, I don't think I owe any money, and here's why. And you got to read his books to really, you know, to get his point of view. But, you know, regardless of whether or not you know, my dad is right or not, I mean, that's not even the issue. The issue is whether or not he believes he's right. I mean, is he a criminal or is he mistaken? And, you know, if you're just misguided, if you have a good faith belief, then that's not a crime. If you believe something in all sincerity, which my dad certainly does, then that's not supposed to be a crime. And, you know, It's certainly a shame, but yeah, I mean, a lot of people. I mean, I get a lot of calls from people. I've never gotten one call or one email from anybody about my dad that was negative, where someone says, "Oh, is that your father? Oh, he's a real, you know, he's a real charlatan," or you know, you ought to be ashamed. Every email or call I get, it's always like, "Hey, I, your dad's a great guy, and I really."
Well, that's all I've ever heard, and references to his books and everything, and I've never heard this story, and I'm just, it's very sad. Let me get to a couple of questions since time is running out. It's kind of funny, the last caller kind of hit on something that I wanted to ask you, was whether you thought it was worth, you know, taking a percentage and putting that in the Merck fund while waiting for you know, this whole unwinding to sort of happen.
I mean, look, you know, you can always decide to have some cash balance, you know, and that cash balance, you know, should not be in U.S. dollars. You know, I make that point in the book, too. And, you know, the dollar is just, of the major assets out there, the dollar is probably the riskiest. Now, I think bonds are riskier than dollars because all bonds are is promises to pay dollars in the future. And the only thing worse than having the dollar today is getting one tomorrow. So the worst thing, I think you're certainly worse off owning bonds, certainly 30-year bonds. If you're going to own any type of U.S. dollar assets, they should be very short maturity, money markets, you know, real liquidity. That way the only loss you'll have is the currency. You won't take a hit on the bond portion.
Peter?
I don't know. I mean, there could be, you know, how do I know? What if these foreign markets go up another 50%? What if they – I don't know what's going to happen. I just don't think – given the inflationary tendencies that are out there right now, I just don't think it makes sense to have a lot of cash. It makes sense to have some, but I just don't think it makes sense to have a lot.
Yeah, I mean, in my case, I was thinking 15-20%, just something.
Yeah, that's fine. But
I'm looking at just some companies that I've researched to buy through my account in Norway. I like the firms. But I know, you know, they're like trading at, you know, 5-year highs, And
yeah, that's one of the problems, and that's true. You know, none of these stocks are cheap the way they used to be when I started buying a lot of them in 2001 and 2002 and 2003.
Right.
But the problem is a lot of money has been created over the years so that, you know, what's cheap is, you know, it's going to change. And a lot, you know, sometimes the earnings haven't kept pace with this. But, you know, I think, if anything, you know, this is really a war. You know, governments around the world are going to sacrifice savers in order to keep asset prices propped up. I mean, this is what conventional wisdom. It's print money. It's, you know, and, you know, we have politicians more and more around the world doctoring up their CPIs and finding ways to, you know, talk about no inflation as they're inflating like it's, you know, going out of style. So, I mean, it just could be that this is just a major, major global inflationary problem, and that there's going to be a huge transfer of wealth from people who have savings to people who are in debt, you know, and or who have real assets. Now, you know, people who have borrowed money to, you know, to do something foolish, like, you know, like take vacations or consume or overpay for condos or something like that, that's really a bad kind of debt. But I think people who have borrowed money to acquire income-producing real assets where the income exceeds the debt service, and, you know, I think they're onto something.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just think that the savers are going to be the patsies in this whole thing.
Okay, and one other theme quickly is I saw somebody from, I don't know, Credit Suisse or Deutsche Bank or one of these characters, and he was talking about the Chinese that probably would not move out of the dollar, not only because their exports would be reduced, and you've talked about this a lot, that they're going to protect themselves in the end, and they have a rising consumer class of their own, but he did make a point that struck me. He said that their own dollar-denominated investments would collapse if the dollar.
Of course they would. Of course they would. But so what? Doesn't matter.
Well, how much? I mean, how much do they own? Not just in bonds and stuff, but how much have they invested in our equities?
Well, a lot. I mean, the value of the equities wouldn't necessarily go down as much as just the value of their reserves and their cash. But the problem is, see, what counts is not. You see, when the Chinese look, let's say a quarter of their assets are in dollars. Let's say a quarter of China's, you know, financial assets are in dollars. And let's say the dollar became worthless. It was worth absolutely nothing, right? So basically what would happen is they would lose 25% of their portfolios as priced in yuan, because they would equate all their dollars. They would put a yuan value on the dollars that they held. So they would see a 25% loss, right? And there was, oh, they can't, you know. But the bottom line is, so they would have 25% fewer yuan. But what would the purchasing power be of those yuan? Would they be better off having 25% fewer yuan if the yuan tripled in value? Well, of course. You know, it doesn't matter if they have less of a currency that's gained in value, and that's what would happen. See, if the dollar became worthless, we couldn't buy anything, which would mean, you know, we use like half the world's gasoline. Well, wouldn't the Chinese be better off if we didn't buy any gasoline?
No, that's a really good point. Is their asset cost would plummet in that case, in a good way.
Look, they would be wealthier. The bottom line, look, if there was hyperinflation, every American would be a billionaire. So we'd all have more dollars, but big deal, they wouldn't buy anything.
Right.
So it doesn't matter. When it comes to paper currencies, the quantity doesn't matter. It's the quality. It's what you can buy. And the Chinese and the Japanese and all these people would be better off if they let the dollar collapse and let their own currencies rise.
Well, I'm assuming they're smart enough to see the logic that you just presented. So what?
No, I mean, there are certain, I don't know. I mean, politicians do all kinds of stupid things for all who knows what reason. So I have no idea why they're doing this or what they think, you know. But all I know is eventually it's going to stop.
All right.
I think we're nearing that point. I don't think that this is some problem that my son is going to be grappling with, you know, who's 5 right now. I mean, I think it's going to be long settled by the time he's a man. I think we're going to have to deal with it, you know. Now, whether it's today, next week, next year, but it's this generation, us. It's not our children. It's not our grandchildren. So, you know, we got to get prepared.
Well, it just seems like a pretty disturbing week financially this week. That's all I can say.
It ought to be, you know, but of course, you know, you wouldn't know that. You know, look at that, you know, the Blackstone IPO comes out and everybody's all hyped up on that thing. And, you know, meanwhile, the shares have now collapsed about 20%.
Well, and they canned that other offering, the EverQuest. they were going to try to sell these CDOs to the public.
You know, and I can tell you, too, I mean, this is all a bunch of crap. I mean, normally, you know, a public offering, when companies go public and when you want to consider buying them, is when there's an existing business that wants to expand. They need more capital. Maybe it's a small business and they want to scale it up and they need money. And the money that you invest stays in the business. But this stuff is not. This is all cashing out. This is the insiders cashing out. The money from this IPO goes to the big founders. I mean, but you know, what's his name? Pete Peterson walked away with a $1.2 billion check.
Nothing like selling me some toxic waste. That's all I can say.
They don't need this money. They want out. You know, you'd have to be, you're their exit strategy if you buy these things. You're taking the other side of the trade. And the crazy thing about the Blackstone is these guys get their cake and eat it too. Not only do they go public and take a huge check, but they pay a small, tiny dividend to the shareholders who buy these shares. They don't even get votes. So basically, instead of earning the profits through the partnership, they're just going to pay out huge salaries to themselves and huge bonuses, and the shareholders get nothing. I mean, what a crappy deal for the people who buy this. You'd have to be a nut to want to buy one of these things.
Well, I think that's one reason they canceled it. They probably are running out of nuts.
There's plenty of them, but the nuts are going to be running out of money.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, have a good week, Peter. Thanks for talking to me.
Thanks for the call, Mark.
Bye.
Anyway, we're getting low on time, so let's not take any more calls. Hey, you know, let's try to get, you know, I've talked about this before. You know, we got to try to generate some buzz on my book. You know, I noticed somebody wrote a review on it. I forget his name, posted on Lou Rockwell, you know, one of these Micey sites. And so it popped up the interest now. It's up to like number, you know, 450 on Amazon. I mean it's been hanging out at like number, from anywhere from number 800 or 900 to number 2,000, you know, total. And it's selling, I mean, a little bit here and there. But, you know, still, you know, there's no real reviews in any major publications. And it's a shame. This is a good book. So, I mean, people, if you haven't bought this book, you know, go into a bookstore, go on Amazon, go on my website, get yourself a copy, get yourself a couple of copies to give them away. You know, I don't know what it takes to get a book noticed. You know, certainly sales should do something. But also, you know, I mentioned before this whole concept. I don't know if anybody's done it, but there are a lot of talk shows out there, very popular conservative talk shows, liberal, you know, talk shows on major networks, on Sirius Satellite. They all take call-ins. I mean, it's very easy to call in and get in on one of these shows. And you call up and you talk about my book. You just say, you know, hey, by the way, have you read Peter Schiff's new book, Crash Proof? You know, in that book he says this, or in the book he says that. And then you start talking about it. And, you know, and maybe that'll generate something, get some interest. I mean, I think the book could make a lot of impact on people if they actually get a chance to buy it. Now, the problem is in the stores, you know, most of the books that really, really sell, the authors, you know, have a bigger following as authors because, you know, they're not first-time authors. I mean, I'm a first-time author. But also, you know, the bookstores and the publishers, they get those books way out in the front. You know, they're up there by the checkout counter on a big stack, you know, and when you walk into the bookstore, you see it. Now, generally, my book is on a shelf in the business section, and there's maybe only one copy there. You know, maybe it's if someone buys it, now it's not there. Now you got to order it. You know, so it makes it more difficult for the book, you know, to really take off. I mean, it's doing well, you know, for a first-time author. I mean, even probably for not. But I could definitely use your help in getting the book out there, getting more people to read it, and hopefully getting it reviewed in some kind of newspapers. And I think that I would love to see what a mainstream reviewer would say about the book. But anyway, again, thanks for listening. I will hopefully be here. If I'm not here, somebody will do the show next week. I will be in Las Vegas for the Freedom Fest. In the meantime, you know, give us a call, 800-727-7922 is the main number. We've got offices, you know, in California and Phoenix, as well as Darien, Connecticut. Go to the website, www.europac.net, EUROPAC.net, and pick up a couple of copies of Crash Proof, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse. That's all for this week. Thanks for listening, and I will be here again next week, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time, on shortwave and my website. Thanks for listening. So long.